On this week's 51%, cooking, farming, and cultivating history. First, a woman in Germany starts a class in cooking for peace.
We have to find other ways to make peace in the Middle East. More and more people realize that. And of course, cooking is a very modest answer to all the conflicts.
An organic farmer tells the story about the hardship and reward of her endeavor. A teenager employs 30 girls to produce a green product. And a New York singer and songwriter tells why he shines a spotlight on women in history. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%. Food might be an unusual approach to help solve the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, but Berlin resident Siska Janssen is determined to find a recipe for peace. She created a cooking class that aims to connect young adults from Israel, Palestine, and Germany by focusing on similarities like food rather than political differences. Mim Philipson reports from Berlin.
It smells like garlic, fried onions, and a whole range of oriental spices. For one evening, this small kitchen in the Berlin district of Wedding turns into a melting pot, and not just of different cuisines. Teenagers and young adults from Israel, Palestine and Germany came together for the very first time to cook, connect and get to know each other. In the midst of the chopping and stirring is Berlin resident Siska Janssen, the organizer of the brand new project Cooking for Peace.
Yeah, we hope just cooking will bring some peace in our minds and hearts here in Berlin.
Und Knoblauch.
Discussing whether to put lemon or lime in the hummus will most likely not be the only controversial topic this project brings up. It's not a political event per se, says Siska. For her, it is more about the social aspect. Siska has been a passionate cook for years and has been actively involved in different social and humanitarian projects back in her home country, the Netherlands. She got inspired to do something about the Middle East conflict when she watched a movie about the topic earlier this year and wanted to find a way to make a political statement through food.
It's so easy to hate each other. It's so easy to fight each other. It's more difficult to find each other in another way. For instance, to talk to each other or to laugh with each other or to cook with each other. Of course, there can be political discussions also. I'm not afraid of that. But I hope it will be a statement to other people here in Berlin and to ourselves and to, for instance, politicians that we can also not argue and not be in a conflict, try to reach each other and to do nice things with and for each other.
Dr. Halima Alayan agrees with Siska Janssen's approach to connect young people from countries that are hostile towards each other through common activities, like cooking. Alayan is the founder of the Talat Alayan Foundation, a non-profit organization dedicated to bring young people from Palestine, Israel, and Germany together to create a basis for mutual understanding and respect. She believes that projects like Cooking for Peace are important to bring about change in the beliefs and attitudes of young people. She knows this firsthand, as she had to flee her home country of Palestine as a young girl and grew up hating Israelis.
Ich hab die Israel gehasst. Warum soll ich Israel lieben?
I used to hate Israelis. Why should I have loved Israel? It's Israel that turned me into a refugee after all. But when I moved to Germany, I started watching films about the Holocaust. I started reading books about it, and I was shocked. It really touched me, and I started to understand the situation of the Jews. I discovered similarities. I started to understand that Israel is very important for Jewish people. It's important for them that they are autonomous. Palestinians should and must learn about Jewish history, so that they also understand the meaning of Israel in a different sense. At the same time, it's also important to understand that Palestinians need a country and a home, so that they have a dignified life.
Dass sie auch ein Land haben und eine Heimat haben, damit sie auch ein würdiges Leben leben.
That's exactly what the participants of the Cooking for Peace project want, to understand each other and to learn about the other side. Like Tali Lutzki, who grew up in Israel and was really excited to come to Germany to connect with Palestinians here.
There weren't any Palestinians to connect with, so that really didn't work out. Like, I know more Palestinians in Israel than I do here, so... I have barely met any Palestinians here, which I actually thought in the beginning this would be a really good place to connect, also based on the history of Germany, which is very much related to what is currently happening in the Middle East. And when you are out of that territory, and there's not the danger, the pressure, the daily life that can intervene with a real discussion, then maybe there would be an opportunity.
That's why Tali attended the very first meeting of Cooking for Peace. She learned about the event on Facebook. Siska mainly uses social media outlets to spread the word about her brand new event. And it's not just a great way for Israelis and Palestinians to connect, but also for Germans to learn about the situation and to help make a difference, says 24-year-old participant Jana Scheurer.
So many kilometers away from the conflict, there's not that much that you actually can do. I mean, it feels good to do something on a local level and just give a sign to the world that, yeah, people here are also thinking about the conflict and also show a peaceful way how to live together. Because, I mean, cooking is something that is shared by all people in the world. So it's a very good way to make peace, I guess.
In history, there have been many important decisions made over a good meal, and many connections have been established while socializing. This was Siska Janssen's intention when she came up with the idea to help create peace through cooking. She knows this project is only a small contribution, but it's a step in the right direction, she says.
We have to find other ways to make peace in the Middle East. More and more people realize that. And of course, cooking is a very modest answer to all the conflicts. But I think if people can see that you can make nice and beautiful things with each other, it really doesn't matter where you're from or what your background is. If you don't know it, you can make a lot of things you thought you couldn't do before.
Siska's very first cooking night worked out perfectly and just like she wanted. There was plenty of activity, chatting, discussion and laughter.
It was very tasty. It was fun.
I'm really happy that I decided to come here. All the recipes were amazing.
I learned to make bread on my own. It was really interesting because I never did this before.
I met a lot of nice people. It was worth coming here.
Friendly faces and open minds preparing and eating a delicious meal is what Cooking for Peace is all about. Focusing on the things that we have in common rather than the differences that keep us apart. Siska definitely wants to continue her project throughout the coming months. There are plans to cook for Berliners at a soup contest in October, as well as for politicians at the Canaan conference in December.
I was planning also to cook in Palestine or Israel with the same idea of bringing people together who otherwise didn't want to be in one room with together, just to realize that there's a lot of more than political issues on the table. There's food on the table.
For DW, this is Mim Philipsen in Berlin.
We now turn to the story of a woman who farms for an entirely different kind of peace, her own. Community Voices reporter Renee Wild brings you the story from Ohio of one local woman's efforts at organic farming.
Many people romanticize the idea of organic farming, but few understand the reality. The truth about making a living as a certified organic farmer is far grittier and much harder than what you see in the glossy pages of magazines.
It is. It's a lot of work. And it has to be a labor of love, I guess, because if it isn't, nobody in their right mind would do it.
In 2007, Sue Borton traded her life in the suburbs for a rundown farm.
From the time I was a little girl, I always told my parents, someday when I grow up, I'm going to own a farm. I'm going to live on a farm and turn my own butter and make my own bread and have a dozen children. Obviously, that never happened. I grew up and lived always in the city.
Sue was in her 40s before she was able to make that dream a reality.
I had looked at a couple other farms, and a broker called me and said, this farm is coming up for sale. I think you need to go look at it here. And the whole time I was driving out here, I thought, this is too far away from Centerville. I don't want to be this far away from my family and stuff. But as soon as I drove over the crest of the hill and I saw the farm, I knew I was home.
The transition was anything but easy.
It had been a rental for 30 years.
So it was rough?
It was very rough. Nobody would have bought this farm. with the right mind. They thought that the upstairs was haunted, and so nobody lived upstairs, and the roof leak, you know, is old wiring, old plumbing, old everything.
Sue started the way most beginning organic farmers do. A plot of land, some packets of seed, and a lot of spirit.
Well, at the beginning, we've tried everything. We put in everything we knew or everything that could grow with seed to see what we could sell and what we couldn't sell. It was easy for me to approach the grocery stores and negotiate with them and come up with what they would be willing to pay us to sell wholesale. Because I knew that was the only way I was going to be able to do it. I couldn't do like the farmers markets or, you know, run around to 500 different restaurants. I needed to be able to sell in volume so that I could also still do the real estate, which is what pays the bills.
The hard part is working with the curveballs Mother Nature throws at her.
It's even more so if you're doing it organically and you're doing it on a small scale. Versus if you were a commercial grower and you had Monsanto and you had all his tricks in his bag with all his chemicals that you could not have to deal with weeds and things like that, it would probably be much easier to try to make a profit. But when you're trying to do it organically and you got to hand pick all the weeds and you got to like deal with all the other issues that you got to deal with, it makes it very labor intensive.
Adding to that is the process Sue has to go through to have her farm certified organic, which is why her biggest pet peeve is other farmers labeling their produce organic without going through the certification process.
Not only do you have to pay the fee, you do have an inspector that comes to the farm every year. He looks over your books to make sure that you're in compliance and check all of your seed packs, and they do an audit to make sure that you aren't buying down at, you know, at an auction someplace and selling. They want to make sure that everything that you're growing and selling is certified organic.
Sue had been doing all of this on her own until last year when she met David Reed, who shares her passion for farming. Sue and David both have jobs off the farm. Sue tried to make a go at organic farming only, but even with grants and interns from local colleges, it was impossible for her to make a living.
It was a rough winter, man.
The late snow and hail was killed a lot. We planted and got 5 inches of rain, and there was cilantro everywhere.
At this point, most people would have given up, but Sue and David aren't most people. So what keeps them going?
You know, it never felt wrong. I have no regrets, ever, not one day. I still believe it's something I should be doing. As soon as you pull in the driveway, you're like, okay, how fast can I change out of these clothes and get into my work clothes and get outside and get my hands in the dirt, because that's where I want to be. It's just so peaceful, so quiet. I mean, if there's 6 cars that go up and down the road in a day, that's a lot. We've had a lot of traffic. You gotta have a good plan. And probably more important than that would be, you know, take some time and mentor under somebody who is a really good organic farmer and has the financial wherewithal to weather the storm, because it's a storm.
For WYSO Radio, I'm Renee Wild, out back of Beyond.
In September, organizers of the People's Climate March say nearly 400,000 people descended upon New York City to demand commitments from world leaders in tackling the climate crisis. The march, which saw companion events in more than 150 countries, took place 2 days before world leaders convened for a United Nations climate summit. Meanwhile, a teenager in the African country of Ghana has been doing her part to stem climate change and protect the environment. Isaac Kaledzi reports about Winifred Selby's efforts to go green in Ghana, one bamboo bike at a time. Selby introduces herself as a young social entrepreneur.
Okay, Winifred Selby is the youngest social entrepreneur who is so dedicated and is really willing to make impact and touch life of many people in Africa.
I met Winifred in the capital Accra as she was about to board her flight to South Africa. She is to receive an award for her bamboo bikes initiative. Now aged 19, Winifred conceived the idea to become an entrepreneur at the age of 15. Her motivation being her humble upbringing and the challenges her family went through.
At the age of 6, things were so hard and so tight in the house that even sometimes you have to sell during vacation because the school fees, where is the school fees going to come from? So you have to take some, if it's a toffee or something to school yourself to your colleagues. When they buy it, then when you come home, you save the money. So that by the time that they resume from the vacation, you realize you've been able to save something small. Talking about bamboo bicycle is not a new concept. So I consulted Benes, Dapa, and Kwame Che that were discussing about this, that, okay, Winnie, this is a good idea that all of us can do it.
The Ghana Bamboo Bikes, which has its operation center in Ghana's second capital city, Kumasi, is a socio-ecological green initiative. It addresses the problems of climate change, poverty, rural urban migration, and high unemployment amongst the youth. The company manufactures bikes that are suitable for the high terrain and rough roads.
There are so many procedures the bamboo passes through before we get a bamboo frame or a bamboo bicycle.
Currently, Winifred employs 30 young females and her bikes are becoming popular day by day. Kafui Dim is a popular broadcaster in Ghana and did ride one of the bamboo bikes at a recently held exhibition program. He's impressed with the quality.
Felt good and stable, and it wasn't too heavy. And I had a spin around, and I enjoyed it. And what was more exciting to me was the initiative being taken by Ghanaians to do something useful, not just for themselves, but for their communities. And that's what's exciting to me, even more than the mere experience of riding the bicycle.
Despite lack of a huge factory for mass production of the bikes, Winfred is excited her business is growing. The company makes a turnover of about $10,000 a month by exporting some of its products.
Bicycle, a frame is $250, and we produce about 90. We have to times the 250 times 90. And if we do that calculation, we realize that this is the bicycle we have been able to produce. So if it's 250, I mean, we get a profit of it. If a cost price of producing a bamboo frame is 150 and we are selling for 250, would that mean we get a profit of $100?
For Winifred and her colleagues at Ghana Bamboo Bikes, the aim is to become a huge company with branches across the country. With such a success story just over 4 years of operations, the future looks bright for this project, which is contributing to reducing climate change and protecting the environment.
That was Isaac Kaledzi reporting from Ghana. For some, this may be a reintroduction, for others, a first introduction to writer, composer, and actor Gilles Malkin, a resident of the Catskills region of New York. He will, in future episodes of 51%, offer profiles of women in history. He explains why he chooses to do this.
The reason I started writing them is because I've always been fascinated with the knowledge that women have been doing so much for so little recognition in the male-dominated annals of world history, whereas I've been in the position to hear a lot about this subject through my mother and my grandmother. They both lived in Paris during World War II, and had so many adventures that are now buried and forgotten, except by my family, under all that weighty history of men and all the important things they did with their guns and bombs. Hearing about the many people my mother and her mother met and worked with to help out in wartime Europe made me want to share how so many other women's actions have affected the way we perceive what is possible to get done. Too many among them have gotten only the barest mentions between the pages of history. But what is history except for accounts of what someone has thought important enough to set down in writing? So, today there's so much media talk about the simple things we need but can't get. How many times have you heard yourself saying, well, why don't the people who are in a position to do something about whatever it is just simply do it? But these issues continue to hang in the air over us like foul smoke for politicians to throw their smurf darts through and thereby have us believe they're doing something. We're also made to believe that everything is much more complicated than we can imagine, so that any direct action is much more involved than we think, and anything we can think of will just not be enough. Well, horse pucky. I think we need to hear a lot more about what ordinary people have gotten done, women in particular, who fully realized their acts would be suppressed and shunted to the side and minimized by men who monopolized the public spotlight. Women who've acted anyway to set an example, not for those who have the power to change the world, but more for those who don't know they have it, by simply going ahead and showing us that anyone who cares enough can change something that needs to be changed. So I set out to air some of their names, their little-known deeds, their bright examples of how a better world is formed. History is really made at this level by so many moms and sisters and aunts and grannies who faced down impossible odds because they knew what was right and because they cared. And they took up what little tools they could find with which to carve doors through the oak walls of inertia and apathy. And I would like to tell some of their stories. These are women who lived long ago, not so long ago, and some who are still among us. I've never forgotten one unsung example of a woman's work I came across at the occasion of my son's birth many years ago. I was walking down the hospital hallway and I came to a bulletin board on which was tacked the page of a newspaper. It showed a photograph of an elderly woman in this hospital demonstrating a simple garment she had invented that could change the lives of an untold number of people if and when it were ever to be called into use. The woman was a maternity nurse, and she'd sewn together an oversized apron with many large pockets. It was for use in case of fire. If memory serves, each nurse who used an apron could carry 10 newborns out of a building quickly and safely. She was saving all their descendants as well. Thank you for listening. For 51% and Women in History, I'm Gilles Malkin.
And now a woman who interviewed those who made history. Ruth Weiss is a legend among African journalists. Her work is now on display at the Jewish Museum in Cape Town in South Africa. Klaus Stacker reports.
Miriam Makeba. My very first question, those were the words with which Ruth Weiss began her numerous interviews. Music legend Miriam Makeba, Literature Nobel Prize laureate Nadine Goldemar, Ruth Weiss met them all. She went to school with Henry Kissinger in the German city of Fürth. She met Nelson Mandela over a bowl of soup in the 1960s and had a chat with Robert Mugabe in his garden.
I met many of these future leaders when they were still part of the resistance struggle. That gave me the chance to build up a different kind of relationship with them. We were almost on first name terms. I was just lucky.
In hindsight, it was also luck that Weiss' father lost his job in Germany just as the Nazis took power in 1933. Being Jewish, he was unable to find further employment. The family left Germany 3 years later and emigrated to South Africa's Cape of Good Hope. At the age of 12, Ruth became a South African citizen. In South Africa's Jewish society, she met leftists and liberal intellectuals, including her husband, journalist Hans Weiss, and writer Nadine Goldemar. While Goldemar discussed politics and literature with men, she only befriended the quiet, almost submissive Ruth much later. Weiss was once asked whether she and Goldemar ever discussed literature or their own works.
I was once asked whether we talked about literature, about her books. I said, never. It was a typical friendship between two women, and it lasted for decades.
Goldemar later realized how she had underestimated her shy friend. In the meantime, Ruth Weiss published short stories and later went on to write novels, thrillers, and children's books.
That was Klaus Stacker reporting. And that closes the chapter on our show for this week. Thanks to Katie Britton for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again or visit the 51% archives, go to our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1317.